chapter 18 this morning, if you'd like to turn your Bible there. We have a lot of visitors, and you've blessed us by your attendance today. Thank you for being with us. We hope your time here will also be a blessing for you. I was thinking as Mike reviewed our very extensive prayer list that it's, I think, a good thing for us from time to time to also pause and especially to be grateful for those that we've prayed for that have been blessed by the Lord with health and recovery. Yesterday, our good sister Cindy LaMasters ran a 5K race. And if you had told me a year ago that Cindy was going to be running anywhere, much less 5K, I would have said that's not even funny to even say something like that. But she ran a race yesterday and was able to complete it. And just so grateful after the ringer that she's been through that she's been able to recover like that. And I just think it's good for us to remember that we've got a lot of people we're praying for. And sometimes those prayers are not answered the way that we want, but sometimes those prayers are answered far beyond what we could ask or think. And that's certainly been the case with Cindy. This weekend, I've had a story on my mind that I heard a very long time ago about a man who was sued by his neighbor because his neighbor said that his dog bit him. So the neighbor took him to court. So when the man went to court, he defended himself and he said, "First of all, my dog is the most gentle animal you would ever meet. There is no way in the world that my dog would ever bite somebody." And he said, "Secondly, my dog is very old. He can't hardly walk. He hobbles around. He doesn't have any teeth. He couldn't bite you. And in the third place, I don't even have a dog." So that was his defense. And I've been thinking about that story in connection with the news that's been coming out of Virginia this week. For those of you who don't really follow the news, the governor of Virginia has had quite a week. Started off with him essentially defending infanticide. And then, lo and behold, this picture turns up from his medical school yearbook in which, on his page, there is a picture of two men, one dressed in blackface and the other dressed up as a Klansman. And you know you're having a bad week when you make this statement. "I can't remember if I was in the blackface or dressed up like the Klansman." That's a bad week right there for you. And so he made an apology on Friday and said, "I'm so sorry this picture came out showing me dressed like this." Then he said, "Oh, I can't remember which one I was." And then yesterday he said, "That wasn't even me, actually." Now, I'm going to make a confession to you. And I might seem very cynical and distrustful when I say this. But I kind of think he's just saying whatever he thinks he needs to stay in office. Now, I know that makes me sound very cynical and mean, but I just kind of have a hunch that the truth is not really the issue here. Power is what is at issue here. It's not unique to him, though. It's true of all politicians, and it's true of politics. Politics is about obtaining power. Politics is about maintaining power, however you have to do it. It's a stark contrast to the Lord Jesus Christ and the way that his kingdom operates and functions. And whenever you have a situation in which earthly politicians collide with the King of Glory, the contrast between what Jesus is like as king and what earthly politics are like is stark and bare. And that's exactly what we're going to see here in John chapter 18 and Jesus' trial before the Roman governor, Pilate. Last week, we saw Jesus' trial before the Jewish court, before the high priest, before the Jewish leaders, in which they have determined they want Jesus put to death. But now we're going to see the scene shift in verse 28 from the house of the high priest, Annas and Caiaphas, to the headquarters of the Roman governor. John is going to make it very easy for us to follow this trial of Jesus before Pilate. What he paints for us here is a series of scenes, seven of them, seven scenes in which the setting is going to shift back and forth from Pilate outside of his headquarters to inside, to outside, to inside, to outside, to inside, to out. And in that way, John is going to help us follow and track the conversation that takes place between Pilate and the Jewish leaders and between Pilate and Jesus. So let's just begin here with scene number one. This is chapter 18 of John's Gospel, verse 28. "Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas, to the governor's headquarters. Normally, the governor's headquarters are up in a city called Caesarea. But during holy days, like the holy day of Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Roman governor would often come into his compound in Jerusalem, because that's always the time of the year when there can be unrest, when things can go wrong, and he wants to be there on the job just in case that happens. It was early morning. It could be as early as somewhere between 3 and 6, which actually is when Roman officials often began their public duties, finishing the day sometime around 11 o'clock. Notice that it says in verse 28, they themselves, that is the Jewish leaders, did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. Remember, the Passover happened yesterday, but now it's the beginning of a week-long feast called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is often just called shorthand the Passover. And what John is saying to us is, these are men who on the one hand are so unscrupulous that they're going to do whatever they need to get Jesus put to death, but on the other hand are supposedly so scrupulous about the law, they want to make sure they are ceremonially pure so that they can eat their Jewish feast. What an irony when you consider, who is Jesus? Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Jesus, who has just eaten the Passover and now redefined it around himself, that he is now the true Passover. So here are people who are murdering the true Passover, but are anxious to follow all the little laws of purification about the physical Passover. So because they won't go into his headquarters, presumably because they think contact in a Gentile environment in the Gentile house will cause them to be impure, Pilate has to go out to them. So this is our first scene, Pilate outside. Verse 29, so Pilate, now we get the name of the governor. There's not a lot we know from history about Pilate, although secular and biblical history indicate that his tenure as governor was very marked by a great deal of controversy and was very tenuous. He tended not to like the Jews. They didn't like him. Jesus even mentions an episode in Luke 13 where Pilate had brutally slaughtered some Jews and mingled their blood with a sacrifice. So this guy, Pilate, verse 29, went outside to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? Why are you here and what's the charge? They answered him, if this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you. Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. Pilate here is assuming that this is just a sort of an internecine conflict among the Jews over some narrow interpretation of Jewish ritual or custom. But what the Jewish leader said to him, oh no, this is something so serious, it's worthy of the death penalty. Verse 31, the Jews said to him, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Now the Jews had some authority, but they are serving under the Roman overlords, and Rome reserved the right to execute the capital punishment. And in this case, it's clearly implied that there is one specific penalty the Jews are looking for. As we're going to see here in just a moment, they obviously make a reference to Jesus' claim to be king in order to convince Pilate that Jesus is guilty of sedition, of treason, of insurrection, of mounting a rebellion against Rome. And there is one penalty Rome imposed above all others against rebels, and that is the penalty of crucifixion. So John goes on here to notice in verse 32, this was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. What word are you talking about, John? Well, hold your place here. Go back to chapter 12. Do you remember that when Jesus comes into the city at the beginning of this week, in John 12, 32, Jesus says, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. There's one penalty that lifted you up from the earth, and that is when you were fastened to a cross. And so, verse 33, he said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So here's what I want you to see here. John is telling us these events, this trial between Jesus and the Jewish leaders and Pilate, it may look on the surface like this hapless victim is being swept up into this political intrigue. John says, no, do not think that for a second. This is the plan and will of God in action. Jesus is in charge. He said in chapter 10 that he's the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. No one takes it from him. Jesus is the one who said, this is how I'm going to die. So this is not ultimately Pilate or the Jewish leaders at work. This is ultimately Jesus at work. That's scene number one. So now scene number two, we go inside, into Pilate's headquarters. Verse 33, so Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Now by this time in John's gospel, it should be clear, anytime someone asks Jesus a question, he's going to immediately ask a question back. And in this case, it makes a lot of sense because that terminology, king of the Jews, is loaded terminology. Typically, what it refers to is the puppet king the Romans had installed, the Herod family, or it refers to messianic claimants, like some of the people mentioned in Acts 5, who stir up rebellion. But neither of those are true of Jesus. And so Jesus responds by asking a question designed to get Pilate to clarify what's really at issue here. Verse 34, Jesus answered, do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? Because if you're listening to them, I've got news for you. They don't have a clue what kind of king I am. Pilate says in verse 35, am I a Jew? I mean, they're the ones who brought you to me. Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? Do you hear that? Your own have delivered you. How did this gospel start? He came unto his own, and his own received him not. Even Pilate recognizes that. And so now, for Jesus to truly respond to Pilate, he has to explain what it really means for him to be a king and what his kingdom is like, in contrast to what the Jews may think and what Pilate may think. So here's what Jesus says in verse 36. Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. Now let's make sure we understand what Jesus means here. When he says his kingdom is not of this world, he does mean that his kingdom is otherworldly, but he doesn't mean that it's so otherworldly that his kingship has nothing to do with this world. Let me just tell you something about who Jesus is. Jesus is king, and all authority has been given to him in heaven and on earth. As he prayed, Father, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, that's exactly what he came to do. My friends, Jesus is king of this world. He is king of the United States. He is king of Florida. He is the king of every molecule of this universe because he made it. So when we say that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, we don't mean that he's king over some region way out yonder, but has nothing to do with here. No, he's king here. What he means, though, when he says that his kingdom is otherworldly is that its origin, its nature, its authority, its source is not derived from this world. In part because, as we've seen in John's gospel, usually the word world refers to the sinful world, the world John described for us when he read Romans 3, the world and its rebellion. Jesus' authority is not granted to him by this world. It doesn't derive from this sinful realm of rebellion. Jesus' authority, his kingship, is not given to him like Pilate got his authority by clawing his way to the top, or like Tiberius Caesar got his authority through conquest. That's how worldly kingdoms operate. It is not how Jesus' kingdom operates. Jesus' authority, Jesus' kingship, comes from God himself. And because of that, it's not the same kind of kingdom that either Pilate or the Jews were expecting. To explain further, Jesus goes on to say in verse 36, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. That's why he told Peter to put his sword away. Because Jesus' kingdom is of a different sort altogether than the kingdoms of this world. But of course, all Pilate can hear is, oh, so you're a king, huh? So once more, Jesus has to clarify what his kingship is like. Verse 37, so Pilate said to him, so you are a king. Jesus answered, You say that I'm a king. But for this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. In other words, there are two ways to lead. There are two ways to influence. There are two ways to have authority. One is through the force of power, and one is through the force of truth. And what Jesus is saying is, my kingdom is not one in which authority is wielded through the force of coercion. It's through the force of conviction by the truth, not by raw power. But what does Pilate say in response? What is truth? Now, Jesus just said, everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. What category now does that mean Pilate falls into? Is he of the truth? No. And as a matter of fact, quite ironically, in John chapter 10, Jesus said, my sheep hear my voice. And there are others who do not hear my voice, speaking of the Jewish leaders. Now that Pilate has demonstrated he's not listening to Jesus, guess who he has now just become like? You remember what he asked a moment ago? Am I a Jew? Guess what? Insofar as he rebelliously and stubbornly resists the truth that Jesus is teaching, he is. And what's most of all ironic is, Pilate is asking, what is truth to what person? The one who is the way, the truth, the life. Just like the Jews are killing the Passover because they want to keep the Passover, Pilate is asking, what is truth? To the guy who literally, the truth is literally right in front of him. The capital T truth. But he's not of Jesus' sheep. He doesn't listen to the voice of Jesus. Well, that brings us now to the next scene, where once more he goes outside. Middle of verse 38. After this, he went outside to the Jews, and he told them, I find no guilt in him. Now here is Pilate's problem. And it is the problem that all of us today must grapple with. Pilate is trying to be neutral when it comes to Jesus. And I'll just tell you, that's impossible. You can't be a neutral umpire when it comes to Jesus. He's claiming to be the king of the whole world. He's claiming to be the Son of God. He's claiming to be God in the flesh. You can't be neutral about that. I mean, he either is or he isn't. And if he isn't, then he's a terrible fraud. If he is, he's your Lord and you need to obey him. There are people today, they kind of want to be neutral about Jesus. Well, yeah, you know, he's kind of a nice guy. He's taught a lot of good things, did a few wonderful social works. It's not going to work now any more than it did then, as Pilate is about to find out. So he says at the end of verse 38, I find no guilt in him. This is the first of three times where Pilate specifically says Jesus is innocent. And here's what that means. Whatever happens from here on, Pilate is allowing it to happen to somebody he knows is innocent. He knows this will be a miscarriage of justice. Verse 39, but you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? They cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. And then John, as if to heighten the dramatic effect of this, says, now Barabbas was, ... a really nice guy who everybody loved. No. Barabbas, he says, was a robber. Probably too polite a word. Some of your Bibles have a footnote on this term that says somebody who leads an insurrection or a rebellion. That's actually how the word is used, both in biblical and non-biblical Greek. It refers to somebody who we might actually think of as a terrorist. And so then here is the irony. What is the accusation against Jesus? He's guilty of treason. He's not. But that's the accusation. We want to murder the guy who isn't guilty of treason, but set free the guy who is a murderer and is guilty of treason. And by the way, Barabbas isn't the only robber here. This word was already used in John's gospel. Back in chapter 10, when Jesus talked about being the good shepherd, in contrast to thieves and robbers who break in and steal. And in that context, who was Jesus talking about? The Jewish leaders trying to steal people away from the flock of God. In a sense, all of those people who were there, who are in rebellion against God, Jesus has already described as being just like Barabbas. Well, once more the scene shifts. John doesn't spell this out, but Pilate must have taken Jesus back inside because in verse 4 he goes out again. So let's look now at this next scene in which Pilate goes inside his headquarters with Jesus. Chapter 19 says, verse 1, then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. This is not the flogging, the scourging made so graphic by the movie The Passion that the other Gospels tell us happens just before Jesus is crucified. This was a less severe kind. At this point, Pilate doesn't intend to kill him, but he does intend to try to show he's not a threat. So he does it by flogging him and also by permitting the cruelty of the soldiers. In verse 2, the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. Painful to be sure, but more of a humiliation than anything else. By the way, it's almost impossible to skip over this text without noting that according to Genesis 3, thorns are a part of the curse of sin. And now Jesus, who has come to bear the curse, actually bears those very thorns on his brow. They array him in a purple robe, the color of royalty. And in verse 3, they came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Here is another great irony in the text. Obviously, these soldiers intend to ridicule Jesus by dressing him like this and beating him like this and mocking him like this. Obviously, what they are saying is, it's impossible that someone doing what you're doing could be the king. And yet, what they are totally ignorant of is, this moment is Jesus' kingly hour. It is when he is doing exactly what the true king should do, who comes, as Jesus says, not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. In fact, Jesus says, "My kingdom isn't like that of the Gentiles. They lord it over, but I come to give." They are ignorant of what true leadership, of what true royalty looks like, because it's right in front of them, and they think it's impossible that this man could be a king. When in fact he's doing exactly what God all along intended for his king to do, save his people. So now the scene suddenly shifts again. Verse 4, Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Second time he said that. Verse 5, so Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." There's a lot of speculation as to exactly what Pilate means when he says, "Behold the man." One of the ancient writers in the 4th century, Cyril of Alexandria, I think, hit it right on the head. Now, first of all, you got to bear in mind, what day is it? So scan down a few verses, and it tells you it's the preparation before the Sabbath of Passover and Unleavened Bread week. In other words, it's Friday. You with me? It's Friday. Now, we read this morning, Ed read from Genesis 1. So Genesis 1, first day, light and dark. Second day, waters above, waters below, separated. Third day, water and land. Fourth day, sun, moon, and stars. Fifth day, birds and sea creatures. What's made on the sixth day? Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Behold the man. And now here the second Adam has come on Friday to reverse what the first Adam has unleashed into the world. Now, why does Pilate do this? Remember, he doesn't want Jesus to be executed. Why does he allow him to be beaten and to be mocked and bring him out here on display? What is he hoping? Here's my guess. I think what Pilate is trying to accomplish is this. Now, you guys are telling me this is some king, some messianic claimant. He's harmless. Look, we can do whatever we want to him. I don't need to take this guy and put him to death. He's not a threat to anybody, certainly not a threat to Caesar. But this gambit doesn't work. Verse 6 says, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them tauntingly, "Take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no guilt in him." They can't do that. So he's essentially saying, I'm not going to do it, and you can't do it either. I'm not going to let this happen to this man. But they play another card. Verse 7, the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he's made himself the Son of God." Now that language, as we've talked about in many classes and sermons, Son of God language is actually standard language in the Old Testament for the Messiah, the promise to David in 2 Samuel 7, "I will be a father to him, he will be a son to me." But what do you think that phrase sounded like to a pagan? He says he's the Son of God. You remember what happened when Paul and Barnabas came into Lystra and the people saw them before they started, you know, "Hey, this is Hermes and Zeus here have come to see us." So can you imagine what a maybe suspicious, superstitious pagan might do if all of a sudden the Jews start using this language, which he's heard in other contexts to refer to divine men that have come from above? Notice what it says in verse 8. When Pilate heard the statement, he was even more afraid. And so he whisks Jesus back in to his headquarters again and says in verse 9, "Where are you from?" Now, that's been the question of the fourth gospel. Let me remind you of one passage. Would you hold your place here and turn back to chapter 9 to the story of the healing of the blind man? And you remember, when the blind man is healed, the Jews can't believe that this man was actually the one born blind. His parents are so intimidated, they won't even identify him. And so once more, the Jews come to him and say, "We don't know," in John 9:29, "as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." And then we kind of chuckled when we read this because it shows how feisty this formerly blind man was when he says in verse 30, "This is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes." Where Jesus comes from has been what this gospel is all about. It's the question that Pilate pretends to want to know, except he's already shown he's not interested in the truth. He's interested in power. So Jesus doesn't answer him. Back to 19:9, at the end of the verse, Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate, you can almost hear how piqued he is by this, says to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." Maybe talking about Judas, but considering that back in chapter 18 and verse 30, the Jewish leaders say, "We wouldn't have delivered him had he not been evil." And in verse 35, Pilate says, "Your own have delivered you." Most likely, the ones with the greater sin here, according to Jesus, are the Jewish leaders. In other words, Pilate, you're not even the most important person in this plot. And you wouldn't have any authority unless God gave it to you. I tell you, I am so grateful that we had the song before the table we did today and the talk that we had before the table today. Because, brothers and sisters, we've got to be careful that we don't, when we come on the first day of the week to remember Jesus' death, that we don't act like the story ended on Friday with a tragic death of a hapless victim. Jesus was no victim, and he was not pitiful. He's already said, "I've already predicted what's going to happen to me." And here he says, none of this would be happening if not for God's authority. Jesus was not a victim. He was a victor. And that's what we celebrated at the table this morning. It's the reason we don't remember his death on the day he died, but on the day he rose. And however else we understand this scene, of course, as hurtful as it is to think about what he suffered, we need to remember he won and he overcame. He is the king getting glory by winning his victory. And that's what he wants Pilate to know here. Well, clearly, whatever else Jesus is, he is not a threat to the empire in the way that the Jewish leaders want to convey. So Pilate tries one more time to get him off the hook. Verse 12, from then on Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, playing their final trump card, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." If you know anything at all about the emperor Tiberius, he was a paranoid maniac. And if he finds out that one of his flunkies has allowed some kingly pretender to get a following, do you think Pilate's going to keep his job? As I said, it's no new thing for a politician to do whatever he thinks he needs to keep power, even if he knows it's against the truth. And so verse 13, when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down at the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement in an Aramaic Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover, Friday of Passover week, about the sixth hour. But notice, Pilate cannot help but ridicule the Jews again. It's almost as if you're going to force me to do this, I'm going to rub your nose in it. And so he says to the Jews, "Behold your king." In other words, you're so weak and insignificant, even the man that claims to be the king, I can do with what I want, and you can't do anything about it. They cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." And one last jab, Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And then the chief priests, who just a few months ago, in a debate with Jesus in John 8, said, "We've never been enslaved to anybody," say, "We have no king but Caesar." Do you remember the story of Samuel? When the people decide they're tired of his and his son's leadership, and they ask for a king, and Samuel's despondent. What does the Lord say to Samuel? "Samuel, they haven't rejected you. They've rejected me from being king over them." These people are supposed to have a king already, and it's not Caesar. It's the king they celebrate when they come together and worship and they read the Psalms, which give adulation to God who is the king. It's the king that in later Jewish tradition, in the second of their 18 traditional benedictions, in benediction 2, they end by saying, "We have no king but you." And here they say, "We have no king but Caesar." Do you remember what Jesus said in John 5? "The one who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him." And by rejecting Jesus, they have in fact rejected God as their king. And so he delivered him over to them to be crucified. Now, what should be glaringly obvious in this account is that it is not Jesus at all who is on trial. It is the chief priests and Jewish rulers who are on trial and exposed for what they are. It is Pilate who is on trial and exposed for what he is. And by the same token, I must say for all of us this morning, it is us who are on trial when we read this chapter. I mean, it's easy to poke fun at politicians when there's such a glaring episode of them waffling and shifting around and prevaricating just to keep power, just so they can keep doing what they want to do. But ladies and gentlemen, that is what all of us are tempted to do. How do you think we got into the plight John read about in Romans 3? It's the very same thing. I mean, every one of us here has to make a decision. What matters to me more, power or truth? What matters to me more, keeping my job, being king of me, or surrendering and acknowledging that Jesus is the true king? Every one of us here this morning has to decide, do I want to just keep doing it my way, or will I acknowledge who the true king is and do it his way? And that's our invitation for you this morning. If you're not a Christian, we would love to help you put your trust in Jesus and be baptized in Him this morning. And if you are a child of God and you've been trying to reserve some narrow corner of your life away from His Lordship, you need to acknowledge who He is. Come to the One who is the truth, and He will set you free. Let us know how we can help while we stand.